I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 147 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week returns to Caro Pop, having added author to his ever-growing list of talents and credits, Steve Wynn. You may know Wynn from the Dream Syndicate, that trailblazing Paisley Underground band whose 1982 album, The Days of Wine and Roses, is a classic for a reason. The Dream Syndicate is still recording and performing vital head-spinning music. Or maybe you know Wynn from The Baseball Project, in which he and fellow singer-songwriter guitarist and Caro Pop guest Scott McCoy offer up catchy rock tunes about baseball. REM's Peter Buck and Mike Mills also are in The Baseball Project, and Wynn's wife, previous Caro Pop guest Linda Pittman, is its fierce drummer. Or maybe you know Wynn from his prolific solo career, launched with 1990's Kerosene Man and continuing with his excellent, reflective, style-shifting new album, Make It Right. You can really get to know him through the just-released I Wouldn't Say It If It Wasn't True, a memoir of life, music, and the Dream Syndicate. Before committing himself to music, Wynn had thoughts of becoming a journalist, and when you read this, you realize he'd have been an awfully good one. He's got a smart conversational style and an eye for detail, as well as a very colorful subject, his years as a budding rocker in Los Angeles. In a lot of memoirs, you want to skip the growing up chapters, but here you find Wynn giving change for a quarter to Michael Jackson on his junior high schoolyard. This conversation isn't a rehash of Wynn's book and career. He's one of those guys who loves to talk about music, with the occasional detour into baseball, so he's come to the right place. Our subjects this time include the guitars that got away, the 1-2 punch of AM radio and punk rock, and whether it was better to have to hunt down obscure music back in the day or to be able to find everything online now. Big Star is one of those bands whose music used to be tough to find, and Wynn has an amazing story of his 1981 pilgrimage via Greyhound bus from Los Angeles to Memphis to track down its enigmatic frontman, Alex Chilton. Wynn also shares his perspective on finding happiness in a long career where disappointment is inevitable, no matter how big and successful you are. Does he consider travel a hassle or a joy? How did writing a memoir transform the way he views his early years? Did it prompt him to revisit or repair any relationships? I love talking with Wynn no matter the setting, and I know you'll love listening to him. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Steve Wynn.
In my book, which we'll get to, but I talk about the fact that I really don't have many regrets in my life. Everybody has ups and downs. You take that's part of the deal. It all worked out. But my biggest regret is all the guitars that I had and don't have anymore.
Right.
You know, when I was younger, when I was starting out, of course, and money was pretty scarce, if I had a guitar and I wanted a new guitar, that meant trading in the guitar I had, adding maybe $50 at the pawn shop or the used guitar shop and getting a new one. And the guitars I let go, let's just say I could, put a down payment on someplace with those guitars, old Jazz Masters and Les Pauls and Telecasters and you name it, guitars weren't collector's items back then. They're just things with six strings you play to make some music.
Right. Well, yeah, because none of you realized that the music you were making was going to be like this thing that was considered kind of legendary. You know, it's like that the guitar sound was like part of these things that became like a much bigger part of our culture than, it felt disposable probably at the time. And then later it looks like the most indelible thing in the world.
Like so many things. I mean, yeah, we've become, and not a bad thing, it's not a good or bad thing, we've become a collector society, a fetishist society. It could be, guitars, it could be records, it could be,
sure.
it could be baseball cards, all kinds of things, cars. I mean, I remember back in LA, when I was in my early 20s, LA is very much a car culture, I think largely because of the good weather out there. Cars last. So you see old early 60s and late 50s Fords and Dodgers and Chryslers
right.
on the road because they haven't rusted the way yeah. they do in another part, like Chicago or New York.
Right. And also you have to drive everywhere anyway, so.
And you have to drive everywhere anyways, exactly. But, back when I was growing up, you could buy a sweet little, 57 T-Bird for just, a few hundred bucks because they're all over the place. So, it's all become collectible and, but things got to move on.
You know, at the same
Impressed.
time, though, like the idea of these guitars having value, I mean, aside from the collectible fetish, whatever you want to call it, the fact that we now put value on something like a, Fender Jazzmaster or a Telecaster or a Les Paul does say something nice about like what you've been doing for your living and for your life, for that matter. Like that there's this perceived value in what made those sounds, and that, we do want to celebrate that. And so that's also a positive thing. People want to be part of that, even if they weren't the ones who were recording those songs.
Absolutely. And a friend of mine, maybe some of you know as well, a woman named Karen Glauber, who's done over the years some promotion for me in my various label time and well known in the music biz. She is a, I believe, a non-guitarist. I'm pretty sure about that. And she made a point to buy and treasure the Jazzmaster that Tom Verlaine used on Marquee Moon. And as you know, it's great that the guitar, for example, is being appreciated and protected and adored on a visual level. A little sad that it's not being banged and strummed here and there. I have a boy. This is fun. We're going to talk gear. I love this. I have a 1975 Telecaster. It's on the cover of the Dream Syndicate Live at Rogers. I used it for a good portion of the years of the Dream Syndicate. And for the longest time, because I'd used it on so many records and tours back in the day, and this had made the rounds, I wouldn't take it out of the house. I figured I can't take this on the road. What happens if I take this to, to a club gig and it gets stolen? I'd be crushed. And one day I realized, well, it's not doing any good sitting under the bed. It's meant to be played. And if someone runs off with it, it would be a sad day. But also it meant it was being used for its purpose and enjoyed. So, that's at the end of the day, they're a slab of wood with a bunch of wires attached to it and some electronics inside to make music.
Right. And you probably made a special effort to keep an eye on it once you took it out. So
I try. I could be
I
better.
felt the pain when your first blonde Telecaster gets like ripped off in the parking lot and they replace it with wooden blocks so you wouldn't notice till later that it weighed something different. Like that was like a I was like, oh man, And then you got a
Saddest part
Jazzmaster,
of
so
the book. Yeah. Well,
it's the tragedy.
Well, the funny thing is, this is when I went to school my second year at UC Davis, and I drove up my little gremlin, my little red gremlin, and was ready to move into a new apartment. And got as much as you can fit in a gremlin to move into my new place, but still 4 or 5 trips up to the second floor apartment I was sharing with 3 other guys. And I had to go down, back up, and back up again. And I brought up my stereo and, my 100 vinyl records or whatever else. And I guess not so wisely, maybe left the Telecaster that I'd gotten when I was 11 years old as the third or fourth trip to the car. And as you say, as I say in the book, that evening when I was finally moved in, I get out the guitar case, saying, "Well, all right, my new pad, I'm going to strum a few chords." And the guitar had been replaced by 3 or 4 wood blocks of wood. I guess it gave me the idea that there was something in there. And
Right. So mean.
the very smart thieves, my God, they were like PhD thieves from Davis. And and I was heartbroken, but as opposed to what we've been talking about, I wasn't heartbroken because there goes a collectible guitar. I was heartbroken because it was my only guitar and I had no money. I was working minimum wage at a record store, so in the course of just wanting to play guitar, not having a collectible guitar, not having a piece of memory from my life, just wanting to have a guitar, I went down to the local pawn shop and bought a Fender Mustang. I think it was a 1965 Fender Mustang for $50. Beautiful red Mustang, and had it. And that was, what was that? Probably about 25 hours of work at the record store, to pay for that, and I gradually, like I was saying earlier, traded up from a Mustang to a Jaguar to a Jazzmaster. And of course, again, like I was saying earlier, those guitars are all collector's items now. Luckily, my bandmate in the Baseball Project, Peter Buck, knows that story. We've talked about it before. And about a couple of years ago, there was a knock on my door And I answered it, and it was a big package from UPS. I'm like, what is this? And Peter had sent me a red Mustang, which I'm looking at right now and treasure proudly, because he's a good guy.
He is a good guy.
He is.
That's a great story. and you, well, also, it sounds like in your collection, you have an acetate of an early John Prine recording. So that sounds like that sort of, for people in the know, that would be a pretty cool thing to have.
Well, it's actually an Al Cooper recording of a John Prine song.
Oh, it's Al Cooper recording. Okay, I remember it was Al Cooper.
Still good. Still good.
Well, still, just yeah. Like, Al Cooper doesn't suck, so.
Not at all. And it's funny because I have, you know, I talk about this in the book. Everybody has a different childhood. And of course, as you write memoirs and everybody tells their childhood, like, you know, and they are all special. But, you know, we all had childhoods. We all, you know, shopped at your favorite record store or had a little tension in here or there, whatever. But I was very blessed because my sister, my older sister, Samantha, when I was 8, married her boyfriend who was at the time working at Liberty Records, which became United Artists. And then by the time I was 12, became a vice president at Columbia Records, which, you know, pretty cool. And he was based in Nashville, and they're, I guess they're whatever division they had out there. But the great thing about that for me, I didn't care about, whoa, you know, record mogul, I'll get signed. I wasn't thinking that at 12. What I was thinking is Columbia had just bought Fender and Fender guitars.
Right.
And I got that blonde Telecaster we're talking about for a pittance because that was his special deal he had. But another wonderful thing about that is he said, my new brother-in-law, Mr. Columbia Records, Ron Bledsoe, still around today, great guy, and he very influential on me. He said, well, come on out to Nashville and spend a week with us. Let me tell you, for a 12-year-old music fanatic to go to Nashville to hang out with a record, you know, company bigwig was great because all of a sudden, well, for one thing, he said, come to my office. I want to show you something. And he had a big cabinet in his office filled with records. He said, take whatever you want. And oh my God, supermarket sweep. I'm just grabbing everything.
Right.
And doubled my record collection in 5 minutes. And that was pretty thrilling. But also he said, well, let's, you know, and bear in mind, I'm 12 years old, but I've already been playing guitar for 3 years, writing songs, playing in bands. And he said, well, I'm going to take you to a recording session. I'm like, wow, recording. I've never seen, you know, I've heard that that's how my records got made. I guess musicians go somewhere and do something and it becomes a record, but I didn't understand the mechanics of it. So we went to a big, big studio. And I mean, you know, it's, you know, even today, I'd probably be impressed. It was one of those old school, probably the Columbia Records house studio. And we go there and there's, you know, all kinds of people working there and a bunch of musicians. And the musician we went to go see was Al Cooper, who of course you know, and I know today,
right.
He's a legend and he did all these things. We could spend the whole show just talking about all the great things he's done. I didn't know who Al Cooper was at 12. I didn't know that he played on like a Rolling Stone. I didn't know he produced, you know, that he formed Blood, Sweat and Tears. I didn't know all that. I thought, does he mean Alice Cooper? That's all I could think. But sure enough, he was there and Al Cooper was recording. I guess, you know, he had enough cachet at that time to have a gigantic recording session. And he recorded this song by an unknown songwriter named John Prine, Sam Stone, which was a beautiful version. And at the end of the session, my brother-in-law said, this is an acetate. It's a solid black, you know, anybody who's held or looked at one, they're pretty, you know, heavy, indestructible pieces of whatever they are. I don't know what acetates were made out of. I don't think it's vinyl, but he gave it to me and I still have it today. The funny thing is later he said, well, we're going to go to another recording session now. Whoa, another recording session. And he said, now, I know that one was pretty fancy. This won't be quite as big a deal, but this is a new artist we just signed and we're pretty, you know, we're excited about him. We're getting him started. And we went to, as I remember, the second floor of an office building with, you know, that looked kind of like, you know, this room with a bunch of crap everywhere and a, you know, tape machine in the corner and a guy playing an acoustic guitar, you know, in a very non-glamorous setting. So this is a new guy on the label. He was Dan Fogelberg.
Right.
So that was pretty wild too. But yeah, things like that, you know, having a brother like that, growing up in LA where just things, you know, the center, especially back then, the center of the music business, you just had things that you came across in your life. You do end up, as I say on the first page of the book, giving Michael Jackson change for a quarter on your junior high school schoolyard. It's LA.
Now, you cross paths with a lot of people. Part of what I really enjoyed about this book is that a lot of memoirs, I would even say most memoirs, like sort of artistic memoirs, I just kind of want to fast forward through the kids, you know, history part, like the growing up, like I grew up on this block and then teachers were mean to me, and you know, and what sometimes the writers don't do, which you do because you're actually a very good writer, and you know, sort of came into it from, you know, also being a journalist, which of course I respect, is that you're connecting all of these stories to the development of your artistic sort of sensibility and growth. It's not just that, you know, someone was mean to you in the cafeteria. It's that, you know, you discovered, you know, you heard Roxy Music, you know, Country Life for the first time, and you turned on, and it was the first weird record that you ever liked, or, you know, other things that happened, but it's all kind of leading you toward, you know, the musician that we know you're going to become. That's why we're reading the book. But it's all connected, and that's why it's cool.
Thank you. And that's the story I wanted to tell with the book. I mean, when I started writing it, you know, I could have written about, like, Richard Hell, for example, did in his book, all the sexual exploits, which do not compare to Richard Hell's, let me tell you. You know, there's nothing wrong, but, you know, that Richard Hell book, for anybody who hasn't read it, oh boy. you know, and I could have written about alcohol and drugs, which does play a part in the story. But I wanted to write about, most of all, was how I fell in love with music and what events in my life might have led me to becoming somebody who really wanted to write songs and make records and stand on a stage and play music. And I, you know, and that's a big part of the book. When I wrote the book, I thought it would be, this is kind of the story. The story is kid falls in love with music. Kid achieves impossible dream of somehow turning that love of music into an actual, if not career, the ascension to a place where people are paying attention to music. Part three, kid does all he can to destroy that good fortune. Part four, kid reclaims dream at the end and everyone goes home safe. You know, that was kind of, and it was just, that was the basic musical journey I wanted to tell.
Right.
And it ends when I'm 28. The book just stops right there. That's the story that ends right at that point.
To be continued.
And it will be, actually, but it will be another book that takes it from there. But, you know, I grew up, by the way, I agree with you about memoirs, like, especially of, you know, music related memoirs. I'll sort of skip past the beginning stuff because, as I said earlier, everyone had to travel. Everybody put the baseball card in the spokes of their bicycle wheel, or everybody, you know, had the mean teacher. Everybody had, you know, this family, whatever. It's great. Those stories can be told. The most boring, or the most, the most uneventful or ordinary childhood can be told in a way where you just say, I'm just flabbergasted by what I just read. That's good writing. But I want to tell the musical story, and I feel for my life, I'm 64, I was born in 1960. And what that means is my earliest memories as a music fan are the Beatles, hearing our 60s radio, discovering music when the charts were filled with things like Motown and the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, right alongside Frank Sinatra and Sergeant Barry Sadler and all that. But all the things we consider classic and essential today, which is AM radio pop. So that was how I discovered music, through these classic yet completely commercial things. And then on top of it, I turned 17 in 1977, which means I'm leaving home, I'm discovering freedom, I'm driving a car, I'm first baby steps towards being an adult when punk rock hits. And that changed my life. That, you know, discovering punk rock at that moment in my life, well, that became everything. So, you know, I was a good age, born at a good time for music to be really central and invigorating in my life. Would it be the same now? I don't know. If some kid who's 17 today writes a book in 40 years about their life, will they say, oh yeah, you know, like I went on Spotify and heard 20 new records that one day and they were all pretty good and then I forgot them the next day. Will that be equally essential? I don't know. It might be a different story that person will be telling.
Right. Yeah. You. It's funny because I was thinking the same thing, and then I come across on page 29 this passage where you write, "I sometimes wonder how my musical development and taste and enthusiasm would have been different had I lived in current times, where the entire history of music is available at the top of a finger to be easily streamed without having to pay a single cent." Because there was this sense of this continuum of rock history, and rock was so young at that point too. And you look back on it, and you're thinking, wow, you know, really was young. You know, it's like, I mean, it's funny, even like you think of like American Graffiti coming out in 73, and it's like, where were you in 62? And that was like oldies. And that would be like, now, where were you in 2013? Like, what? You know, it's like, it's just a totally different sense of this history. But, you know, what do you think your answer is? Like, could you have had this kind of musical development if you were, you know, turning 17 this year?
Yeah, good question. And I mean, it's funny because I've, you of course know Linda, my wife, Linda Pittman, are your previous guest of yours. And we talk about this a lot. We've, you know, in recent years seen, you know, of course, like people of our age, well, actually of all ages, we've seen McCartney or Dylan or, you know, the classic rock titans, you know, the Who, we haven't seen the Stones on this tour, but we're seeing this kind of last gasp or two of what we consider the Mount Rushmore titans of rock. They're all out there approaching or passing 80 and touring. Will there be another era like that? Will there be in 30 years the same kind of thing? Or are we seeing the last? Is this a dying thing we're seeing right now? Sure, there'll be. What will the next wave be? And I could even ask you, it's like, will there be a similar thing for Wilco or the National or you know, or great bands, you know, but will we ever have this kind of a thing where rock music was so new and monumental and groundbreaking that we have grown old with them and seen them to the finish line? I don't know. What will it be like in 40 years? We'll be saying, oh my God, you know, I can't decide whether to spend all my money on Taylor Swift or Lana Del Rey, which is it going to be? You know, we can't say. I guess every age you're born into will have its own same sense of nostalgia, I think. And the right now, if you're 17 right now, the upside is you can be so eclectic in your taste. You can know everything. Right. And you can have a band like Krongbin, which is fantastic. And that's a band that maybe wouldn't exist if they couldn't easily access every corner. Now, I think they're actually, having read about them, I think they are vinyl fanatics and they actually go out and find the original versions of things. But you can get a crash course education in the history of music if you want it so easily now. And
oh, sure.
Some 17-year-old will school me on, you know, on the deepest cuts from a small corner of India from the early 70s that I had no idea about. Great.
Oh, but I mean, I remember going to great lengths to track down those big star records because, and you write this whole section about going to, you know, on this pilgrimage to meet Alex Chilton in Memphis in what, 81, I think. And, you know, so, and it's funny too, because you also talk about introducing Scott Miller of Game Theory to Big Star, because you thought he sort of wrote similarly to Chilton and he didn't even know who he was. And I think the first song I ever heard from Big Star's third was the Game Theory cover of You Can't Have Me on the Real Nighttime album. Because I just didn't, you know, I didn't have it at that point. And I'd heard of them, and like, you would see the guys from REM, your friends, you know, Peter and Mike would be, you know, giving their Desert Island Discs, and Radio City would be in there, Big Star third, and be like, what is this, you know, what is this record that these REM guys, because I was really into REM and I reviewed Reckoning in college and loved them. And actually, and it's always killed me, by the way, that I missed that Aragon show that you opened for them in 1984, because I was doing the Summer in London program and I'd seen them the year before in school. I was in school in Philadelphia and I saw them on the Murmur tour and I really wanted to see them again. And I missed that show, which I've heard the XRT recording of, have not heard the recording of you guys opening for them, but I'm sure that was an amazing show. And then I saw them with the DBs opening for them that fall in Philadelphia. But anyway, to go back to Big Star, I just, you know, it, I mean, I think at some point I was able to find, because they'd re-released Big Star's Third. And so that's actually the first one I got. But I'd heard like the Bangles cover September Girls, and I'd heard Let's Active play Back of a Car in, you know, in concert. And it was really not until I was in LA the summer of, you know, after I graduated college, I went to Tower Records, and they had like an Italian importer bootlegs of Number One Record in Radio City. And that's when I got those records. And it was like, oh my God, I found the records. And I went to my friends who we were staying with and listened to them, you know, and like devoured them. And I'm like, oh my God, this is those records. You know, now you just go on YouTube and you'd be like, click, there it is. It's just like, there's no pilgrimage.
I guess, and maybe if you, right, I'm not sure how it'd be, but maybe if the same thing happened in your life now, let's keep it to Big Star, and you're, you know, you might find it, you might say, oh yeah, everyone's talking about Big Star, and you go and hear it on YouTube or Spotify and say, whoa, it is everything I thought it would be. Anyway, on to the next record. You know, right. You can beat a, I don't know. I
mean, it's great that you can hear Big Star on YouTube, you know, like it's cool that like you don't have to, you know, fly to LA and find an Italian bootleg. But on the other hand, right, there isn't that sort of attached value to the music because it took you so much effort to get it.
And all the information was so piecemeal because, you know, how would you find out about things? Well, in my case, when I discovered, not music for the first time, but the music like Big Star and a lot of the punk rock band, things like that, it would all come from, let's say, New York Rocker or Trouser Press or maybe the NME, if you could get it on your newsstand, things like that. And you'd get little clues along the way. And, you know, the Big Star chapter is funny because I do write about when I was 21 in 1981, being so obsessed with Alex Chilton, I get on a Greyhound bus from L.A., straight to Memphis, 2,000 miles, in the hopes I will meet this guy who made this very, very, very under the radar music that affected me so strongly. Right. And I can't emphasize how much, like you're talking about, when you came to them a couple of years later, there were starting to be little ripples of bands like REM and the Bangles covering the songs, a little bit, more awareness. I would say in 1981, there were 50 people in the country, and included was Peter Buck, Peter Holzapfel, and a couple, you know, I could probably name all the people in the country who had Big Star.
Stamey.
Well, he was on the records I was buying.
Yeah.
and so was Peter Holzapfel, for that matter. But you know, the thing that prompted me to go to Memphis was hearing in some magazine or newspaper article that Alex Chilton was playing in a band called the Panther Burns. Panther Burns, what is that? I don't know, but Alex Chilton's doing now. I got to know about this. I got to find out. So I go to, well, I don't go to the record store. I'm working at the record store. So I just, you know, order. So I get a copy of the first Panther Burns record. It was a 10-inch record with, I think, four songs on it. I don't have it now. But it was their very first record with no information. All there was a listing of the songs. I think I might have listed the band members. And as it turns out, Alex was the drummer in that band, I believe. But there were no credits. All there was an address in Memphis on the back. And that was enough for me. It's insane. As I talk about it, I can't even believe it. I saw this address on a Panther Burns record, and that's it. I'm taking a bus to Memphis and going to that address. And say, what? And so I do. I get off the bus. And once again, like my guitar sob stories, didn't have a lot of money. You know, I think a Greyhound bus pass for the whole summer was $200. So I go to the address, boom, knock on the door. Guy answers the door. I say, well, hello, my name is Steve. I'm from Los Angeles. I'm trying to find Alex Chilton. The guy who answered the door was Tav Falco, the singer of the band, of course, unknown at the time. Now, you know, well-known in the underground rock circles.
Right.
And Tav says, well, he's not here, but I know where to find him. And he takes me to a bar, and there's Alex sitting at the bar. So, you know, all these things, it was so mysterious and exciting because now you would just say, well, I know all the information within a half hour on Wikipedia. I'm going to find Alex Chilton's Facebook page and message him and end of story. But I had to, you know, it was the pilgrimage.
The Alex Chilton episode is so fascinating because, like, on one hand, you know, he's this guy who made this incredibly meaningful music to you and to me and to a lot of people. But he's just a guy sitting at the end of the bar, and he's embittered by this whole experience and kind of self-depreciating about it all. But, you know, he'll And he'll sort of get this kid to buy him cigarettes and beers until you run out of money. But also, you know, puts you up in his house and makes you grits for breakfast. And it's like, it's sort of charming and sad and all these things. Did that experience, which, you know, for a 17-year-old sort of meeting one of your, I mean, assuming that's the most, you know, contact you'd had with one of your musical heroes at that point, did that sort of shape how you kind of viewed what you were doing when you were getting better known and people were coming up to you? Did that kind of shape your whole attitude about the whole, you know, musician in public kind of thing?
It did so. I mean, the big thing I took away from that, and very unfairly, is by the time I left Memphis, when, yes, I had run out of money, I couldn't buy him cigarettes and beer anymore. At the time, what I took away was, well, like you say, he was bitter. He, you know, despite having giant hits at a young age with the Box Tops, he obviously really, I think, cared about Big Star, and they were giant. They were failure. That's part of the beauty of the Alex Shelton story. Of course, you know, the Alex Shelton story wouldn't be the same if there hadn't been that early success and then devastating failure. It's all part of the myth. And you know, to see the guy who lived that myth, he wasn't happy about it. He wasn't happy that people didn't like his band. And in fact, in the week we spent together, he was very, in retrospect, very gracious to me, very willing to talk, very smart, interesting guy who loved talking about literature and romance and philosophy and history. Just don't talk to me about Big Star. That's off limits. Mm. And I realized that pretty quickly. And by the time I left, I thought, well, I can't ever listen to Big Star again because he was so bitter about it, it broke my heart. Well, that's a naive 21-year-old kid. And in retrospect, the takeaway is how nice he was to me, how much time he gave to me. I don't think I would do that. If somebody in the middle of our interview knocks on my door and says, hello, I just came from Memphis to Queens, and I want to talk to you, Stephen, when I say, oh my God, 911, I need help here. I do try to always be friendly with fans and talk to them and understand where they're coming from, because they're like, you know, younger fans or fans my age just love this music, you know. But the one thing at the time that I did take away from that is that I won't ever be bitter this way about things. And true to that pledge, and I don't think about it every day, but the fact of the matter is, I've had ups and downs. I've had some very wonderful ups and some very devastating downs, and it's all part of the process. You know, you just kind of realize, well, you know, God, I don't want to be all, you know, Pollyannish about the whole thing, but everything that happens takes you to where you are. And in my case, I'm making music after 40 years and just putting out my 33rd album and touring all the time, and isn't that great? So I don't know. Over the years, I did kind of here and there stay in touch with Alex. And in fact, Linda and I saw his last show, Big Star show in Brooklyn. He died 2 months later.
Right.
And it was a beautiful night. And we actually, Alex and I, had maybe our first kind of long hangout discussion together as peers, not as fan and receiving end of fandom, but just as peers. And it was a beautiful night, and it was heartbreaking and devastating when he suddenly and very sadly passed away.
Right before the big blowout tribute concert at South by Southwest, where
I know,
including Andy Hummel, who then he died like a few months later.
That was heartbreaking on so many levels. And that he passed away at 59, when he was such a vibrant, engaged, alive person, just beginning to see the fruits of what he had done in the 70s. The show we saw in Brooklyn, were about 800 people there, and they were going bonkers. And
yeah,
and you could see he enjoyed it. A little flicker of, you know, actual enjoying it. And that was wonderful. And he would have been blown away to know, you know, I think he would have been blown away to know 10 years later, his old drummer and, well, my current bass player, one of my bands, and a bunch of other well-known musicians are traveling the world playing his music to people everywhere and playing to thousands of people every night. It's great, but such a sad thing that he didn't get to enjoy it.
Yeah, I was at the Chicago Tribune in 93, I think it was 93, and saw that Big Star was reuniting at the University of Missouri at Columbia, Missouri. Back then, I could convince the arts editor to send me down because I'm like, this is a big deal. I know you never heard of Big Star, but they're a legendary band and da 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 da. And I called the students who had, you know, invited them thinking there's no way possible and that they would do it and talked to Jody, who also thought there was no way they would say okay and all this. And I went down to that show and it was like in a parking lot in a tent next to this basketball arena where Bryan Adams was playing that night. And it was like the middle of the day. It was like this list of bands. And in the middle of this list of bands, like after Puppet Show was, you know, Big Star. And a lot of people, and, you know, they came out and they played and it was just a fascinating, you know, it was like some of it sounded amazing. Some of it was a train wreck, but sort of amazing in its train wreckiness. And afterwards, Jody said to me, "That's the first show we've ever done where the people knew our music."
Wow.
And like, you think about that in 93, you know, and even afterwards, there's actually this, you can find this on YouTube, but like there were some people were sort of talking to Alex afterwards, including me. And I was like asking if he was going to do this again. He's like, no. It's like, did you see any reason, you know, any way that you guys would do this again? He's like, no. And he was, of course, that was not true. So we were happy about that. But it just was, that was sort of like the beginning of that.
Yeah. I mean, I'll add to that that I saw them, one month before 9/11, I saw the Box Tops play in the courtyard at the World Trade Center between the North and South Tower. Mm. It was like August 2001. How heavy is that? But they played a noontime show, the Box Tops. And I think it might have been a lot of original members, including Alex, of course.
Interesting.
This is a noon show, much like your afternoon show you're talking about and Puppet Show and all that.
It was like the spring festival that I was at, you know.
Well, this is a show they were playing for office workers on their lunch break, coming and going. Maybe 50 geeks like me in New York excited to see if they're going to play Neon Rainbow, but you know, but everybody else just, you know, taking their lunch break while this oldies band plays. Alex was so happy. He was having the greatest time. He had a different relationship to the Box Tops, I think, than Big Star at that point. And this was the band he wanted to play with. This was the band.
Interesting.
With, I guess, lots of good memories. And I was kind of stunned to see the guy I thought of as a caustic, you know, maybe bitter, maybe ironic, maybe like, you know, attention and passion in some other place. He was sure loving playing them, probably like a baby in the winter for a bunch of, you know, people eating their Subway sandwiches, you know, on a lunch break.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great beers include the classic Antihero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. It's still technically summer, and there's no better way to refresh yourself than with Cold Time. It's never pasteurized, it's brewed low and slow, in a method that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, and a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's available in 12-packs of 12-ounce cans. Almost every musician has, you know, the tale of kind of the rise and the triumphs and the disappointments and the bounce back and the coming to terms with things. And, you know, there are huge disappointments in every artist's tale, basically every human's tale for that matter. And it's interesting to, you know, like those who sort of are embittered by it, like, oh, we really never enjoyed our success. And I look back and, you know, I'm rueful about it, as opposed to, oh, that was really great, and I really embrace it. You seem like you're more in general on the, you know, on the positive side of, you know, these are all formative experiences and you've had some great ones.
Yeah, it's funny what you say too, because I think about this all the time. Aside from the Beatles, who broke up before they were 30, or, you know, I think, you know, they broke up young,
yeah,
and they were still at their peak. Everybody, and I mean everybody who's made music for a long time, and we're including people we've talked about, the Dylans and McCartneys and Neil Youngs and Stone, blah, 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 have all had points in their career where they just didn't matter anymore, where they, at least in their minds, you know, were has-beens, were yesterday's news, where we're out there trotting out the oldies because people didn't want to hear their new stuff. They've all had those moments of, what am I doing here? I'm going to assume for them. I remember seeing an interview with Dylan in the 90s where he said, you know, I'm not playing any new songs. People don't want to hear my new stuff. He said something like that. You know, they want to come. So I'll say, hear the 60s songs. In his mind, at age, what, you know, 35 or whatever he was, I can't do the math on when, no, older than that. But in his 50s, he felt like he was an oldies act. And look, that was before Time Out of Mind. So everybody who, well, like I say, everybody's life has ups and downs, but definitely if you're an entertainer, if you're involved in something as undefinable as and impossible to quantify as providing entertainment, you're going to feel like your best days are behind you, or people don't want to know your stuff, or you've lost the magic. It's part of the deal. For me, it's not like I haven't had moments where of disappointment. Of course I have. But maybe, you know, maybe because, as I point in the book, I had those first moments of disappointment so early, I just kind of put my head down and say, everything I do is just a new chapter. It's a new record. My happiness doesn't come from levels of success or success in terms of numbers. It comes from success in my own mind of how good a record was. And if I finish a record, as does happen after this many records, where I think, I almost got it. I wish it would have been a little bit better. I wish that one mix was different. I wish I'd sequenced it differently. I wish I would have changed that one lyric that bugs me now. Those are the disappointments now. And then when I make a record where I think everything was exactly the way I wanted it to be and it surprised me in a really positive way, that's a good day at the office. Right. It's why I love touring so much. I love touring for many reasons. I love travel. I love, you know, that I get to do this. But I also like the fact that every night is brand new. If, you know, if I played Detroit last night and I broke three strings and couldn't stay in tune and forgot the words of that song and the audience was, you know, yawning halfway through, well, I'll play Chicago the next night and it'll be the best show of my life. And Detroit will be a long forgotten memory. And that's, you know, that's a beauty of touring. You don't think in terms of, hopefully you don't think in terms of where's my career going. You think in terms of, well, maybe this will be the best show I ever played.
Right. Yeah. There's something to be said about the fast turnaround, whether you're a musician playing live or you're on the radio and you know, the tomorrow's show will be better than today. Or I don't know, like when I was writing, you know, three stories a week for the Chicago Tribune, I'd be like, well, that one wasn't the best, but this one's pretty interesting. But there's something to be said for the churn sometimes where, you know, you get to keep, doing what you're doing as opposed to, you know, doing something for like, you know, working on one thing for 3 years and then go, oh, that was a letdown. Or something like that.
Yeah. I was thinking about you, actually. I was thinking about you as I was saying that, because a journalist, and of course, you know, as I say in the book, I wanted to be a sports writer before my music thing really kicked in. And writing reviews or being a sports writer is a similar thing. You're traveling and every day is a new chapter. And I'm sure, exactly. I'm sure I can imagine you were reaching many more people with the Tribune that I reach at any given show or record or whatever.
I'm not sure about the record part of it, but yeah.
Maybe we'll have to compare numbers or not.
People are still playing your record, but nobody's still reading those old newspaper articles. So, you know, although I encourage anyone to go look up my old 1993 Google Big Star 1993 and me. That's a good one. But okay. just for the subject of this thing. But yeah, I would say that your music is lasting longer than my, you know, newsprint words.
It's all out there.
Having written, you know, reviews of albums, you know, before you were recording albums, did that give you any sort of different perspective on when you read reviews of your own stuff? Like, did that make you think, oh, okay, I know where they're coming from because I used to do this.
That's funny. You know, I mean, I did take my sports writing dreams very seriously. The rock critic thing that I did do, in fact, in college, was just a way to get free records and get tickets to shows. I never really thought of myself as, I guess I was pretty decent, but I didn't, you know, get that excited about that, you know, beyond just like wanting to be proud of it. But I will say from my journalism days, I have a pretty good sense of what things I say will end up in the article. As I'm doing the interview, I'll say, they're going to use that.
Right.
Or, oh, that'll be a pull quote. That'll be, you know, that'll be the lead. So I kind of know sometimes. And I think that, you know, I think the Dream Syndicate from the beginning was a pretty good band. You know, I think fortunately other people would agree, but we had some advantages from the start too, in that, well, I worked at the coolest record store in town, Rhino Records. So I had a, you know, connection to hardcore music fans and the local scene, and also having been a DJ in college and having been a music writer, and also most of all being a big music fan, all these things, I kind of knew what was good and what wasn't good, what things, my bullshit detector was pretty strong, you know, my sense of, yeah, do it this way and it's going to be cooler than if you do it that way. And going back, bringing back, you know, Peter Buck, for example, he's very similar, was then and is now. He was such a music fanatic and devoured everything in sight. I think that was one of the strengths of REM, is that Peter just knew that as well. Not that Mike and Bill and Michael didn't, but Peter was the one who, like me, just had, you know, was omnivore for anything related to cool music. And then he would say, yep, I don't think that my favorite band would have done it this way. They would do it that way. And I don't think that, you know, they would say this in an interview. And I enjoyed subverting the entire live experience by breaking the fourth wall, by saying things on stage other people wouldn't say, by saying things in interviews that other rock stars wouldn't say, things that kind of made it fun, you know, whether it was a well-crafted lie or a little, you know, Easter egg within, you know, like putting the Days of Wine and Roses. Not a lot of people know this. Some people caught it, but the retaining groove, we're talking etching things in retaining grooves. That's a long forgotten thing.
We put on
pre-motorcycle accident. For anybody who might look at that and know that we were talking about the cool Dylan stuff, Bob Dylan stuff, being before the fabled motorcycle accident. Things like that that might connect with four people in the world, and that was enough reason to do it. That was kind of the thing that, you know, that we were into, and I'm still into today. I still enjoy things like that.
Did reviews of your records, especially the early ones when there were kind of like more reviews of everything, did they surprise you, or did they say what you thought they would say?
Well, I think the latter. I think kind of, you know, we knew we were good. Maybe most bands will say that, but we had a lot of awareness of what, you know, I spoke recently with Vicki Peterson, who's here and another guest of your show, I believe, right?
Yeah.
And she lives at least for another week or two here in New York. And we get together a lot. And we did a mutual interview that came out today on the Talkhouse website. And in talking to her, even though I know her so well, I realized when they were starting out the Bangles, they were coming more from that poppermost of the poppermost kind of thing, where they were aiming to be the band they were, band with number one singles. We, in the Dream Syndicate, and my own take on things, I just wanted to be a band that was written, beloved in a fanzine, or you know, got or appealed to rock critics. It's true. I mean, because people like you were the stars to me. I was a reader of Cream, Lester Bangs, and Ed Ward, and Richard Meltzer. These people were important to me as the people making the records. I remember one of my first favorite books was a book called Stranded, which you might know. And it was a book of rock critics writing about their Desert Island record. And it was great. To me, that was up there with my favorite records, the way people wrote about these things. So I had that sense early on about a critical evaluation of music. And I wanted to make music to fit into that narrative. Well, sure enough, it worked. And it wasn't a calculated thing, it's just my mindset. And it was a stunning first year of the Dream Syndicate, first even year and a half or 2 years, where we got written about unanimously with glowing reviews in every publication. We may not have sold a ton of records. We may not have been packing out, you know, the Forum, let alone the Greek Theater, let alone, you know, places smaller than that. But the people who we cared about loved us to death. And it was exciting. It was very gratifying to see that we'd made that connection. In a similar way, when Medicine Show came out, our second album, and received negative, at least in the States, negative reviews and or just shrugs, it kind of broke my heart. Like, well, we tried. And I knew that no matter what, if I was honest with myself, the disappointment that the target audience of people who cared as much about music as I did didn't particularly like it, broke my heart. Mm. Then that was the first taste of disappointment in the outside world and in myself, even though I do like that record a lot.
Yeah. But also your descriptions of the making of that record are so torturous, and it's sort of like you come around to appreciating the album by the end. But, you know, you have periods where, you know, your guitar riffs are being replaced, you know, months later in the studio. And it's just like, and it's just being fussed over in such a way. And I'm reading it going, oh, this just sounds so hard, you know, for someone like you who really is prolific and likes to kind of capture the moment. And it's like sort of a different way of operating. And it sounds like you sort of at the end, because, you know, when you did your vocals and you sort of were able to commit to that process instead of being pissed off at that process, then you were like, oh, this is actually a really good record. And then it broke your heart because the reviews weren't there. But it's such a kind of roundabout way to produce that art. And sort of telltale of what was happening in the music business at that time.
Well, yeah, and it was all new ground. You know, it was, as you know, we made the Days of Wine and Roses in three nights, and really, we made the bulk of it in one night, a midnight to eight session, and that's a record that to this day will define everything I ever do. We made Medicine Show over the course of 5 months. 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, with almost no break during that time, nonstop. And again, as I said earlier, I had a sense of how cool things were done and how cool things weren't done. And I knew this is not the way that records I like were made. And I was 23, and I didn't know how to put the brakes on or how to steer it back towards something that felt right to me. And yeah, those first 2 or 3 months working that way were just driving me nuts, were breaking my heart on a daily basis, and I couldn't find the way to get out of it. For every bit of, you know, knowledge and obsessive history collecting of rock music that I'd had, I didn't know how to fix this. And my bandmates, well, particularly the guitarist Carl Percota, was loving it because it smacked of what rock stars do. The producer Sandy Pearlman, that's how he worked. So I didn't have an ally. But as you say, and as I talk about in the book, at a certain point, I said, well, this is not the Days of Wine and Roses. This is not the record this is not the process I would have dreamed of years ago, but it's what I got. So how do I make something out of this? And I did, or we did, but to a large extent, I did, and found the way to the finish line with a record I liked. But it was a lesson learned early on that I still use to this day, which is, you know, get in there, do the work, get out, you know, make it right. Good, but there'll be another record next year. Just get in there and make the best one you can to move on.
And part of what's fascinating is you describing the live tour afterwards when you're touring with REM, and you're just doing shows behind this record, and, you know, you've got different personnel in the band, but you have people who are coming out who have heard Medicine Show, but you have people who are coming out because they love the Days of Wine and Roses. And it's like you have these sort of the river's very different at those two parts of the stream, and you're trying to find the happy medium between them. And it sounds like you mostly do, but you're sort of like talking about playing to the back row or beyond, and which is different from what you were doing earlier. And just again, just finding your voice, and, you know, like where you are as a band when you're actually producing it every night, as opposed to spending, you know, 5 months producing one, you know, album. It's like it's a different thing. It becomes an organic process again.
Yeah, and you know, and we went on that tour. We consciously wanted to be the band who made Medicine Show. We at that point, by that point, were saying, this is the album. We love this album. This is who we are now. As you say, different band members, the personnel had changed. We had changed bass players at that point twice, and added a keyboard player, and decided we were the Medicine Show band. Maybe not the ideal move, because I think that was, not to overstate it, but it was a pretty significant tour in the development of this music scene that was underground rock, indie rock, college rock, whatever you want to call it. This was the tour where I think I call the chapter Our Side One, which is true. Suddenly, the scene that was in playing New Wave Nights and, you know, in Birmingham, Alabama on a Tuesday night to 30 people, suddenly the scene led by REM as this, you know, the flag bearers of the scene, are playing to 3,000 people sold out every night, selling at the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago. We're doing this incredible thing that none of us could have imagined 2 years earlier. And it was exciting. And we could have just said, all right, guys, look at REM, look what they're doing. It's time to double back and be Days of Wine and Roses Dream Syndicate and make it back. We didn't do that. We just did what we wanted to do. And it's funny because The show we did, you were talking about the Eric on it, came out as a live album. This is not the new Dream Syndicate album live. And I heard that somewhat recently because it's going to be reissued next year. And I like it. Nothing I've ever done sounded like that before or since, but it was really kind of a cool band. But it was not in the flow. It was not in the narrative of what REM was doing. And what they were doing was miraculous. They were taking this thing to new levels every night, and it was great. So it was a funny tour. But
right.
And they
changed their sound eventually, just not on that second record quite as much.
Well, I would say they did everything so well. And I think maybe partially because they were in Athens and shielded in their own thing, because they were all, well, of course, every band has bumps along the way, but they were four friends who stuck together as that band for a long time. They became big in a nice gradual way. And by the time they became an arena band, they were just a great arena band. I saw them a lot on their final tours because by that point we're bandmates and you know, hanging out all the time. And man, they, you know, for all those great early records or later records, and that, they became a great arena rock band. Those shows, they could play to 20,000 people in a basketball arena and just connect in the same way they might have connected at CBGBs 15 years earlier, 20 years earlier.
You had a great line where you're talking about the days of Wyatt and Roses. You said, I could tell you every song I was trying to imitate. None of them would be actionable because none of them came out sounding like those bands. But it was all kind of building blocks. The development of Dream Syndicate, the development of you, it all was part of this bigger kind of movement of what was happening in music and popular music and rock at the time, seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, we were all, I don't know if this is one thing, but this is one way things might be different now. We were all figuring things out step by step in real time. How do you go on tour across the country? How do you do that? I think in the 60s and well, in the history of rock music before our scene, before this early 80s scene, the idea was to be huge, to be on a big label, to work your way up to being a big band. There wasn't that pride. There wasn't that glory in being unsuccessful. The Dolls wanted to be big, New York Dolls. The Stooges were an elector. They were in their somebody's right. mind, they were going to be stars on the same for even the Velvet Underground, you know, in their weird way, or the Mothers of Invention, or
big star, number big one star. Record. I mean, they called it number one record.
Yes, you were supposed to have success. You know, that was, all the bands I loved, the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the only ones, for God's sake. And I mean, all the idea was you were going to have success. And our era was maybe the first reflection of the glory of being underground heroes. Honestly, I never at any point then or now harbored ideals of, well, of course, when this is all done, I'm going to be, number one on the charts and riding around a limousine. I didn't. Well, there were a few limos along the way. They were fun. But there was never that idea that I was going to have a mainstream successful career. And I was fine with that. I treasured that. And yet the funny thing is, and I'm pretty sure this is true. I'm waiting for someone to tell me I'm wrong about this, but I think we were the first band of our whole scene to get a major label deal. You know, I think that's true. Yeah, what's the metaphor? Lambs thrown to the wolves. I'm forgetting that. We were the sacrificial lambs to the machine. And, we didn't see it that way. First, we just, I can't emphasize enough how many decisions we made back then once things got going that we didn't have time to evaluate the wisdom of. You know, I wish we'd stayed in some ways on Slash Records. But when all these labels come around saying, when EMI and Geffen and A&M are all saying, we want you, and what do you want? We'll give you anything you want. You think, well, okay, I'm not going to say no to that. You know, I'm not going to take a backward step to SST instead and just show them, what can be done. We just figured out, right. So there were things along the way we had to figure out, well, how do you do this now? How does that work? Now I think that most bands can easily, they'll still make mistakes. Everyone's going to make mistakes, but I think you can kind of figure it out pretty quickly. Well, if I want to play that club, I do this. If I want to get on this label and do it that way, or just go on Bandcamp, whatever. It's a lot easier to navigate now, I guess what I'm trying to say.
Right.
And we had no idea.
I'm going to now ask you what I was going to ask you to start this, but then but we just start talking, which is great. what was it that prompted you to want to write a memoir, and in working on it and writing it, how did it make you sort of look back on what you've done differently?
Well, I do joke at one point in the book, or at the end of the book, I do say, I always wanted to have written a memoir or have written a book. It's just, I never got around to writing one because I'm busy, and I'm touring and making records with a bunch of different bands. So, you know, the idea of actually writing a book, which takes, you know, as you know, it takes some time to write it and edit it and make it the way you want. Just didn't have time for it. What happened was around about 10 years ago, I was asked by a writer at the New Yorker named Alex Abramovich he emailed me, asked me if I could give him a couple quotes, a couple sentences or paragraph about my thoughts on the Velvet Underground album Loaded, or reissue was coming out. And in my typical fashion, I gave him 2 pages, 1,000 words about Loaded. And he wrote back and said, well, you're a good writer. Have you thought about writing a book? I said, yeah, I've thought about it. I haven't done it. He said, well, I know an agent at ICA, a big company in Manhattan, and he specializes in memoirs. I could set up a meeting with you. You know, I went, wow, okay, I guess now's the time. Okay, so I met with the guy, and the guy said, yes, I would love to shop around a book if you write one. All I need from you is 2 sample chapters, and I'll do that. I said, great. This is 2015. Well, I had a lot of tours coming up, and it took me 3 years to write those 2 sample chapters, and it kind of, you know.
Happens.
I'm going to do it. Next week, I'm definitely going to do it. Oh, shoot. The second I get from the tour, I'm going to do it. And finally, I write those chapters, which were the chapters about Alex Chilton and the chapter I write about touring with you, too. I chose kind of 2, you know, well-known subjects, I guess, or subject of interest. I went back to the guy and had a meeting with me. So, well, I'm not doing memoirs anymore, but good luck. So I went, okay, that was that. Well, like a lot of people, when the pandemic hit, I had to find things to fill my day, and I started writing the book, and I was amazed how easily it came together. Granted, we all had time on our hands. I had a big swath of, you know, it's funny to think about this now, and you know, here we are on the other end of the pandemic, on the other end of what happened in 2020. But at the time, as we all know, as you know, as I know, everyone knows, we didn't know when the end would be. We didn't know if this was our new life that would never go back again.
Right.
And so, you know, I thought, well, I guess the rest of my life is just making video concerts with Linda and writing this damn book. So I did knock out the book pretty quickly. And to answer your question, as I was writing it, I'm reliving my life, and I'm thinking about things from my parents and growing up and divorces in my family and discovering music and yes, the medicine show debacle and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, I got to kind of revisit all these things that happened in my life. And I don't know if there was one giant lesson I got out of it besides it all worked out, which is great. That's, you know, that's an easy pat, but also true answer. Like, well, here I am, and I made it through all that. I'd say the one thing that came from writing the book, the one thing I did learn that I hadn't thought about that much, was how a lot of the things I regret came from not being able to just sit down and talk to people that I cared about, that I was friends with. Typical folly of youth. You know, if you and I have a dust up after a show, for some reason, if you say, well, I like Big Star Third more than Radio City, I say, Mark, you're out of your mind, you know, and I'm never talking to you again. The next day I'd write to you and say, what was that all about? Come on.
Right.
We're not like that. But at the time, I would just say, or maybe a person at that age would say, fine, I'm done with you then. Time to move on. And there's a lot of that in the book, be it bandmates like Carl Bricode and Kendra Smith or other people in my life, where I just found that roadblock. And rather than trying to figure it out or talk it out, we just say, the end, I'm moving on. And that was a little hard when I read those things. It made me a little sad. To how much people who are so important to my life were just dismissed because of one stumble or one disagreement or one difficulty. Is that typical for everyone's life? Maybe, but I,
yeah.
You know,
Did that prompt you to do anything? Like, did you sort of reach out to anyone and sort of after writing stuff, or even just sort of when you were kind of researching things and thinking about it, going, you know, what really happened then? Maybe I should ask someone else what their perspective is or something. Like, did you reconnect with people because of the book?
Not, I have tried to reconnect. For example, the big case that has Carl Pakoda, the original guitarist in the Dream Syndicate. And long before writing the book, I've tried to connect with them a few times, and for whatever reason, and no one that I know, none of the people who knew him and knew me, nobody knows what he's up to, except that he's very, very bitter, or I shouldn't say bitter. He wants nothing to do with the Dream Syndicate. I recently, I don't want to say names because maybe this was set in confidence, but I recently met a musician whose father works in the father works in the world of academia, and Carl Pakoda is a professor at, I believe, Virginia Tech in theater arts. And this musician found out that his father was going to be having lunch with Carl Pakoda to discuss whatever their teachings or the current life of, you know, college education. And this musician I met said to his dad, I want to come to that lunch because that's Carl Pakoda. And he said he went there, you know, be fly on the wall. And I think at some point in the lunch, he said, by the way, Mr. Pakoda, or Dr. Pakoda, I am a big fan of Days of Wine and Roses. And apparently Carl just froze and went silent, and he could feel the chill in the room and quickly abandoned that tag. He just, that's the way it is. But I've tried to reach out to him over the years and zero response. So be it. On the other hand, Kendra Smith, our original bass player, who we also had a parting of the ways, our parting of the ways wasn't a bad one, just was she moved on and did her thing, and a great good thing with Opal and the bands coming before Mazzy Star. She was part of that. We recently connected and have remained friends, and she's same old Kendra, same friend I always has. That's nice. I think rather, I didn't do the thing they do in 12-step or went back, you know, to revisit everybody. I just try to live my life better now. I try to address things. You know, the Dream Syndicate reunited 12 years ago, and with Jason Victor, my longtime solo band guitarist and, you know, one of my best friends in the universe for decades now. And we've been playing together, and we love playing together, and we're great friends, and he's my right-hand man, and we have a way of playing guitar together. It's so beautiful and effortless and so symbiotic. But when we made a record called These Times, the second comeback record, we had a hard time in the studio. We, for whatever reason, and it's a long story, best told in the next book maybe, but we had one of our few real bad stumbles, and just kind of, I want to kill him, and he was hating me, and, you know, as will happen. Well, instead of what I might have done 20 years ago, I called him up and I said, we're going to meet in this bar on Avenue A next week, have a couple beers and talk about this. And by the end of the evening, he had said everything, and I'd said everything, and we were back in business. We were,
right.
if not on the same page, we understood why each of us had said and done and acted the way we did and done the things we did. And that was great. That was a lesson learned from, you know, from the things I'm talking about.
Yeah, it enabled you to keep going. All played at Lincoln Hall, what was that, a year ago, a little more? Sounded fantastic, so.
I love the current edition of the Dream Syndicate. You know, it's something that, again, doesn't get talked about much in the book, but all the things in this book about, you know, of course, the bulk of the book is the Dream Syndicate's rise, fall, the ups and downs. And by the time we broke up in 88, we were all very proud of what we did. I was very proud of the records we'd made, the things we'd achieved, but it felt like unfinished business. There were things I wish we would have maybe done a little differently, all detailed in the book. But the great thing now is we get to finish the story the way we wanted to. And we've made 4 albums in the last 10 years that I just adore and feel so proud of. And I think that we did something that's very hard to do for a band that reunites, which is to not only do it well and honor who we were, but take it to a new place that's different enough, adventurous enough, and yet true to the original blueprint, and keep it going. And that, I guess, comes with age, maturity, knowledge, and most of all, good luck.
Yeah, I would agree with both of those points because, A, when bands get back together, they rarely sound like they did. And you're like, oh, you know, that souffle has fallen. And also that they sort of don't tend to kind of continue to evolve. And I would say that you guys have done, you've beaten the odds in both cases. So that's why it's still pretty great to see you. And also listen to those records. They're fun to listen to. You know, they definitely have this adventurous spirit and you're like, oh, there's some really cool songwriting and, you know, really cool interplay going on here.
So, you know, for all the, I get asked, you know, one of the favorite interview questions is name the record that changed your life. Great question, especially if you're a music fan, and say, well, the record that changed my life is The Days of Wine and Roses. It's, you know, right. Quite literally, it changed my life. So that's an easy answer. But I will say the record that we made 4 years ago, The Universe Inside, is my favorite record I've ever made. I've just, that's I don't know, from my own personal taste and what I like, I don't know if I can top that. I'm so happy with that record. So that's a good feeling. I made that record, you know, when I was 60, and I really liked that one. So it's a good feeling. Yeah.
You have a new solo album as well, Make It Right. And it covers a lot of stylistic ground. You know, it has like, you know, kind of country ballads and, you know, psychedelic rave ups and nuggets sort of songs and a stretched out thing. First of all, did working on the book kind of inform how you approached going back to doing an album now? And I won't bundle questions. I'll ask that one first and then I'll ask another one.
The answer is yes. And in fact, the records, it has a variety because it wasn't recorded at one session. It was recorded with different musicians at different times, but it was all written and recorded while I was writing the book. And that's kind of the unifying thing. I wanted to have a record to go on tour with when I toured the book. The book is, you know, and my wonderful label Fire Records would not be shocked to hear me say this, but the book is the focus of what I'm doing right now, only because I've never written a book before. And it's a special thing to be, but I wanted to have a new record that I could go on tour with. So there would be a musical connection. And when I started looking at material, I had songs I've been working on writing, in the last 5 years, I realized not only that they would make a good record, but also that they reflected the writing of the book. They were all very personal. There was a lot of the songs were about looking back and wishing you could fix something or make it better or, right, you know, change this or that. Well, there it is. That's everything we've been talking about for the last hour.
I mean, it's called Make It Right. And there's a title song, which was the one that came out first, that it was just a really nice song also.
And Make It Right. Another song's Making Good on My Promises. Another song, the first song, Santa Monica, where I was born, talks about, you know, if I could change things in the past, I'd probably go and fuck it up some other way, the line from the song. So there is a lot of that in the record that actually fits in with the book. And I approached Fire Records, my label, just to say, hey, look, I've got these songs and I'd like to put it out. I think I'll press 1,000 copies, you know, myself and take it on tour, but I need your permission. And they said, we really like these songs. We want to put out ourselves. I went, great, wonderful. And they said, and we're far enough along the process now where I can say this. They said, the only thing is don't say that it was written or recorded over a period of time, because then people say, oh, compilation. We don't have to pay attention. I said, okay, mum's the word, but I can say it now. It is kind of a patchwork kind of record, but it does, like I say, it does all fit in with the book. So it is thematic.
No, it makes sense together as an album. Also, isn't like almost every record recorded that way now? I mean, it's very rare that, I think so. I think that, you know, I think that, I don't know. Like a lot of albums have, you know, multiple producers, multiple sessions, multiple this, that, and the other thing. So it's, you know, it's very...
Yeah, you're right. I mean, God, look at a lot of records that were done in different studios and different times. A lot of the Stones records were done that way. You know, Tattoo You, Black and Blue.
Tattoo You, there aren't even any sessions on. Like there are literally no recording sessions for Tattoo You.
Yeah, it's just all thrown together. And same with a lot of Dylan stuff, you know. So, yeah, right. It's completely normal. Funny thing, I still love going to the studio and making an album. The last Baseball Project record was, you know, the five of us in Mitch Easter studio for a week.
Right, I love that.
seeing what we got, you know, and that was fun. I still love doing it that way.
You have a great line in the book early on about how, like, not only have you written about 1,000 songs, but you're confused when someone doesn't write songs, that it's just such a natural thing for you to do. And that you have, and that you'll play with musicians and bands particularly, and you'll be like, how could you have never written a song? Are you just like in your everyday life, do you just get ideas for songs and go, oh, better stop and go write this down or start, you know, find these chords or something like that?
Yeah. In a different way than I used to. I mean, when I was younger, I'd write, you know, 1,000 songs a week, and just, you know, it was kind of, I guess, without being conscious of why, it's just because I was learning how to do it. You know, the band I had before the Dream Syndicate, Suspects, the band I had in college with Kendra Smith and a couple guys who formed True West, man, I was writing songs nonstop, but I was writing songs nonstop because I was thinking, how do you do this? This is fun. This is a new thing. I will admit these days I tend to write, I'm always jotting down a line here, a lyric there, a song title here, a riff, recording it so I don't forget it. But for the most part now, I tend to write for a record, you know. New Dream Syndicate album coming up, I better go and play a D chord for a half hour and see how that drone motivates me to do something else, you know, whatever. It's more project driven than it used to be.
And band driven too, like for a Dream Syndicate band record, you're gonna approach it differently than if you can say, oh, I'm gonna write a solo record now.
Or even more specifically, a baseball project.
Right, record. Or the baseball project,
we know,
of course.
We know what that's going to be about. So that's very specific.
No, it's fun reading about you being a baseball nerd as a kid, because I'm just like, oh, I know where this is going. You know, it's like foreshadowing the merger of your worlds and you know, like loving the box scores like you love those music charts. I'm like, oh, this makes total sense.
I can't believe I finally got to be a sports writer after all these years. It took me 40 years to go from dreaming of being a sports writer, and instead of writing for Sports Illustrated, I'm writing for, you know, the Baseball Project.
Right, a sports songwriter.
A sports songwriter. Who, what, when, where, why? It's all there. You know, when we get together to make Baseball Project records, Scott McCoy, my bandmate who writes the bulk of the songs we write for the albums, we always talk about, what's the angle? Oh, I'm going to write a song about Alex Rodriguez. Well, what's the angle? You know, it's a newsroom meeting. We get together and, you know, like, okay, how are we going to present this one? And, you know, okay, you got the story. Go out there. Give me, instead of 2,000 words, give me 47 words by 5 o'clock. Okay.
Do you and Scott sort of exchange, you know, messages, texts, emails throughout the year, like whatever storylines are happening for each season, like, oh, the White Sox are historically bad. What's the song?
Oh, yeah. Of course, we have a baseball project constant email group thing open, and it's going all the time. It's you know, me and Linda and Mike Mills and Scott all talking about this baseball article and this game and that, and Peter barely tolerating us because he's the one non-baseball geek in the band. Yeah, and believe me, rock and roll baseball nerds are out there. I'm part of three different chat things. I'm in a fantasy baseball league with a very, very cutthroat league with Scott and Mike and Stephen Malkmus and Steve Berlin and Ira Kaplan and a handful of other people. And yeah, we go at it. It's funny because back, you know, when we were starting out, and Carl Percota was actually a big baseball fan. That was one of the things that kept us able to even be in the same van after a while, because we had something we could talk about and not come to fisticuffs. But there are a lot of musician baseball nerds out there.
Sure.
It's crazy. I didn't realize till recently.
Well, and I think that the first time I met you guys was when Len Casper was the Cubs TV play-by-play, and you played at the House of Blues in Chicago when the first album had come out. And I think Len was introducing you because I think it was a fundraiser for maybe the Theo Epstein charity to be named later. I'm you know, probably getting that wrong. But I remember talking to Len and then, you know, seeing you guys and talking to you guys. And then Len's formed a band and, you know, they just put out their second album, Sonic 45. And so when he's not calling, doing the radio now for White Sox games, poor Len, you know, he's playing these songs.
I know. And, it's funny, you know, when people come to me at shows, after shows, fans, I mean, you know, I love talking to people, but if they come up with, saying, oh, I love your music or this, that's not, it's nice to hear. But as they come up and bring up baseball, we're off and running. I mean, I will talk baseball anytime to anyone. It's weird. This is kind of, I looked up yesterday. It's rarely happened where no team wins over 95 games. And that could happen this year. There's no really one great team yet.
Yet there are all these great players. I mean, like Aaron Judge is going to hit, 70 home runs without steroids, presumably.
I hope so. I hope he does. That'd be great.
The Yankees have been interesting. So you're a Yankees fan, right?
I am. I like the Mets and the Dodgers too. Mets because I live here and Dodgers because of LA, but I'm a Yankees fan. That's just the way it is. And they're interesting team because they're kind of really a two-man team with little bits of help here and there, but it's working so far.
Right.
I don't think that can go too far into the playoffs with just two players who are consistently good, but we'll see.
The ex-Cubs on the Yankees, not a very good year. Rizzo was doing terribly, and then he's out. Gleyber Torres, who you guys got for Chapman in this World Series year, off year, maybe not in the plans anymore.
And Chapman was kind of a bust after a while also.
Right. Yeah, and then you got him back anyway. You got everyone back who you traded to us. So, and then, what's his name? You had another ex-Cub. He wasn't a Cub for that long. Another first baseman, D.
LeMahieu.
LeMahieu, yeah, DJ LeMahieu.
And of course, I know that. I know that because I don't know if we wouldn't know this, but my one time I've thrown a first pitch at a ball game was at Wrigley Field, and he was the catcher.
Really?
Because he was a rookie on the Cubs at the time, and so he gets the job of catching the first pitch. So he was unknown, and he was my battery mate.
That was a terrible. That was one of Theo's, if not Theo's worst trade, was trading DJ LeMahieu and the first round pick, who was the bigger name, but he didn't do anything, to the Rockies for Ian Stewart, not the Rolling Stones Ian Stewart, and that one didn't turn out very well. But anyway, thanks so much, Steve, and take care. Okay. That's all for episode 147 of Caro Pop. Thanks so much to Steve Wynn for continuing this ongoing conversation. Can't wait for the next one. Wynn is touring the UK September 16th through 24th, and on October 8th in New York, he launches a US tour titled I Wouldn't Say It If It Wasn't True, A Night of Songs and Stories. Tour dates follow in Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Charlotte, Atlanta, Nashville, Cleveland, and more cities, including Chicago, where I plan to catch him October 20th at the Hideout. Go to stevewynn.net for more information. And be sure to pick up his memoir, I Wouldn't Say It If It Wasn't True, and his new album, Make It Right. You can follow Steve on Instagram, @cultartist, and Twitter X, @stevewynn. Caro Pop is produced by Chris Swake. Who wouldn't produce it if it wasn't true? For a mere $24, you can become a Caro Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at caropop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on Twitter X and Instagram @CaroPopcast. You can follow me as well @MarkCaro @MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop conversation. Thanks.